Hey, this is Kevin Kane with Boston Strongcast. I'm joined by the one and only Alyssa Orlando. And today, basically, what we're going to do is a little, like, Q&A, mixed thoughts. We're basically just going to ramble on into the microphone for approximately 35 minutes and hope something coherent comes out of it.
We pulled the Team Precision group text for some thoughtful hints, some of which we took and some of which we very clearly ignored. I'm going to kind of ask these as general questions and then we'll just chat. So the first thing that I think a lot of the group members wanted to talk about, and maybe Kevin, you can answer this, is just like mobility and recovery in general and how it relates to the sport of powerlifting. I know you have your opinions on it. I think other people on the team have other opinions on it. So maybe just going back and forth.
Well, let's get one thing straight. The only opinion that matters is mine. But like mobility stuff. So I think, like, this is kind of like a hot topic because I think in a lot of cases you have a, you know, there's a group of coaches and authoritative figures maybe in the field that try to push mobility as something that is a must have in every program. And I do agree with that aspect of it. However, you know, I think we're stuck in this thinking that mobility has to be a special stretch or a special warm up, or you have to use a special lacrosse ball that's been blessed by a priest and a foam roller that weighs 100 pounds. Like, I think, you know, we think of mobility as literally just utilizing those tools and unloaded stretches and stuff, but that's not necessarily what it is. So, you know, powerlifting doesn't require that much range of motion. You have to be able to squat to depth, you have to be able to bend over and pick up a bar that's 8.75 inches off the floor, and you have to be able to lay on a bench. Like, that is literally all you have to do. Yeah, you can arch more and stuff like that.
I was gonna say, you need arch.
But like, the things that fix these things are just training. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to load those end ranges to get better at them, and the more you do them, the better you get at them. However, they're, you know, for health reasons, which a lot of people are advocates for mobility stuff, which I do agree with, but it doesn't have to be special stretches or lacrosse balls and stuff. So in powerlifting, for example, our shoulder blades are always pinned together. So we probably want to do stuff in our accessory work that takes them out of that position and allows your shoulder blades to explore some different movement patterns. So as you've seen in your programs, medial delts gets in there.
I do like
it's just to get some upward rotation of the scapula. Your medial delts are not increasing your total by any means, but like, you're exploring different movements.
Yeah.
Seated dumbbell overhead press has been in there before. Same thing, you know, we'll do some lats at different angles. Like, it's just so that your shoulder joints are going through that range of motion. You know, and with that said, if you're a competitive power lifter, everything you do in the gym should be going to get you a bigger total or have a bigger carryover to that. So for our warm-ups, we take the empty bar. So me personally, I take the empty bar for 3 to 4 sets of 10, and then I put plates on there and I take it for anywhere from 1 to 3 sets of 5, and then I get into my 50%. And for all my lifters, everything from 50% and higher is written out and calculated into their total volume. So the warm-ups are already taken care of. Now,
what about warm-ups that make you feel good?
I don't care what you do.
So, like, I come from a cheerleading background, so, you know, when you, like, get to practice, you do, like, a whole bunch of weird things, but I think that's also just because you need a bit more flexibility in that sport. You know, you have to, like, move your leg all the way over your head, which takes a little bit more flexibility than a squat.
It's different, right? So, like, powerlifting, your feet stay in one place. So there's no change of direction. There's no jumping. So there's really no better way to get warmed up for it than to take the empty bar and just get that range of motion. Yeah. At least you get some technique carry over there. But yeah, for sports, you know, that require like short burst sprinting or jumping, and yeah, your warm-up has to be a little bit more involved because there's going to be, if you think of your, say in like football, you know, a 10-yard sprint is kind of like your top sets, right? You got to work up to those top sets.
Yep.
So you might do some type of like skipping or whatever you're doing in your warm-up to get to that point. It's the same thing. So the empty bar would be those skips for us, kind of like that first thing that you would start like moving around and doing. And then as you increase the load, you're going from a jog up to that 10-yard sprint. But all of that stuff is planned into our programs. It's just done in a way where there's going to be carryover to getting a bigger total. You don't have to lay in a foam roller. You don't have to do special stretches. Just, you know, no movements are up too. Like, get up and just, if you know you're going to be stuck in positions for a prolonged period of time, yeah, that's bad. And like, you know, people bring lacrosse balls to their office and like use them and stuff. I think that's great, but not for the reasons that they think.
Yeah.
It gets them up out of the positions that they're in for a prolonged period of time and just gets them moving around. And I think that has some benefit, but just drink enough water where you have to take a piss every freaking half an hour and, you know, you're going to explore different movements.
So what about recovery?
So for recovery, eat and sleep. That's it.
I like that.
Like, you know, those are your two biggest bang for your buck recovery things. Yeah, I have nothing further to say on the recovery piece. I think the other part too is like if your program should be a good balance of days that really stress you out, days that are kind of average, and days that are below baseline that actually help you recover. So if we, you know, vary movements enough, it just has to be subtle. It doesn't have to be a lot. But even a slight variation of movement allows certain motor units to actually take a break while you're squatting so that the next day you can come and you can hit it a little bit harder. You know, like something like a pause squat is going to be easier to recover from if you're using 70% or 75% than, say, you know, doubles or triples at 85%. Just allow certain motor units to recover. So as long as you're programming your stuff in an appropriate way, you know, block pulls are going to be easier than pulling from the floor. Board press, easier than touching it. Slingshot, easier than touching it to recover from and stuff. And every muscle group has its own recovery curve. So like your pecs are going to be a little bit behind on the recovery curve than like your delts.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're probably not making your medial delts sore enough that you couldn't train them every day because you can't really stretch them in the same manner. But that's getting into more complex things. So my answer, eat and sleep.
All right. I like that because I like eating. What about people who are in like caloric deficits though? So people who may be like cutting a weight class or people who have like really stressful jobs, work, like our friends who work 12-hour shifts, how are they supposed to not compete at the same level, but in a sense, how are they supposed to increase their recovery? Are there other things that they can do?
So it's hard, right? Like if you're working shift work, no matter what you do, you're gonna kind of be behind the eight ball a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Try to like make your room as black as humanly possible so you don't have sunlight in there during the day. You know, try to get on a routine, but like sleep is still not gonna be as good. And in those cases, you have to manipulate the training a little bit.
Okay.
So the shift workers don't get as much volume. So like Nick, because of his job's more physical and the hours kind of suck, like he doesn't go to bed till 3 or 4 in the morning, he actually gets less volume than Dave, who kind of is on a regular schedule as a coach. You know, if you're in a caloric deficit, you know, it's tough. You could probably like, I mean, it's a complex answer because it's gonna be a little bit different for everybody. But you might not be able to handle the amount of volume that you're typically used to. So like intensity could come up a little bit and volume could come back, and there's gonna be kind of a figuring out process in the beginning of what you're capable of lifting. But I think, you know, as long as your body fat's high enough and you have some to lose, you can maintain strength while in a caloric deficit pretty easily. I don't think that's a problem. Kristen kind of covered that a little bit on our previous podcast, which you should listen to if you haven't already. I mean, that's a loaded question, but higher intensity, lower volume on a caloric deficit, you'll be all right.
Okay, awesome. So I guess we could work through kind of how, starting at the beginning of, you know, your powerlifting journey, let's say, how would you recommend that someone choose a coach, both if they're in an area with the ability to go see someone, or if they live in really deserted areas that don't necessarily have a strength center like we are blessed to have?
So I think the number one thing to do if you're looking for a coach is find the one with the most Instagram followers.
I was going
to
say, so you should troll Instagram and find someone.
No, but I think, you know, I think number one, it should be somebody who this is their full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody has a job that they do 40 hours a week and they're a coach on the side, you might want to seek out a more qualified coach, like somebody who actually does this for a living. Their track record You know, ask who they've coached. Like, do some digging on their personal experiences, their educational background, stuff like that. I think if you formulate some good questions to ask, mm-hmm. right? I think, you know, with what you're looking for, I think that's really important. It should be almost like an interview. Like, think mm-hmm. of going to a job interview, except you're the employer and you're, you know, you're trying to find an employee. I think, you know, everybody has stuff on social media now, which I think is great. I think, you know, you could get a good synopsis of how good of a coach that person is by looking at their lifters and that coach themselves, like their technique on the lifts and stuff.
Yeah.
And you kind of get a feel for what they're doing. Like, they shouldn't be missing reps. The technique, it should look good. Their lifters should look good. They should be using appropriate weights. I think stuff like that. I think it's hard because there's, like, if you're a beginner, you don't really have any background in this. You put a lot of faith into whoever you're reaching out mm-hmm. to, and chances are they're gonna fucking suck and you're gonna have a bad experience, but it's a learning experience, and you kind of, like, figure it out over time. I think the great thing, since we've had this, like, burst of raw powerlifting growth, there's a lot more information out there for raw powerlifting. So you could just, you know, Google some basic information on what, like, a good powerlifting program should look like, the things it should entail, and you can formulate some good questions. Like, places like Juggernaut, reactive training systems,
Strength Athlete.
The Strength Athlete. Their podcast is great. I'm blanking out on some, but there are plenty of resources out there that you can do some digging. And it's worth your while, because if you get a bad coach, it's harder to break a bad habit later on than it is mm-hmm. just to learn it firsthand. So you want to try to start off on the right foot. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, with the way technology is, I don't see there being a problem with finding somebody online. Like, I work with Borashiko. That's the only coach I've ever worked with. But it was the same thing. Like, I wanted to become a better coach myself, and, you know, being a student lifting weights, I think, was, you know, really important, and doing it in a way in which, you know, he was kind of conducting the whole thing was what I was looking for. And obviously his track record speaks for himself. And I feel I get enough from sending my videos to him and getting feedback, so I think that's fine too. Most online coaches are pretty good at, like, texting back and forth and stuff.
I would also say, like, don't be afraid if you are maybe thinking about taking one coach on. Don't be afraid to reach out to some of their athletes. Obviously, like, with social media, that is a really great tool. I know we've had some issues in the industry recently with coaches, so not being afraid to, you know, if you're interested in Kevin and you want to DM me on Instagram, you know, you can do that. And most people are pretty open to sharing their experiences about how that person is as a coach, and not necessarily just, like, the programming aspect, right? Because there's also, like, that personal relationship involved. Your coach can be the best programmer in the world, but if that person doesn't like you, then you're probably
not
getting the most out of it as an athlete. And that might happen. You might fall into a coaching situation where you're not getting the most as an athlete. So just like a relationship, it's not uncommon to seek other coaching experience. But again, you also don't want to jump from program to program. So just being mindful of your place as an athlete with a coaching relationship or without one, I think, is important.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, reaching out to the people, I think.
Because, I mean, like, we're pretty cool, right? I would say that if somebody reached out to us and was like, should I hire Kevin as my coach? I'd say no, obviously.
And then I'd give you more squat pyramids.
Oh, that'd be so bad. Right, so moving on. The question originally was, like, the general question of sumo versus conventional. I think we should just, in general, talk about, like, the different ways in which people perform the lifts, right? So, like, high bar versus low bar, I don't know, like, really arched versus not very arched, sumo versus conventional. What does that all mean? Does it really impact people? Can you get by with doing whatever you want? That sort of thing.
All right, so if we're gonna talk all three here, that's a big question, so we'll try to make it small as possible. So I think, in general, especially if you're newer to the sport, if you can manipulate the range of motion to your benefit and then train the shit out of it over the long term, you're probably going to be better off. So high bar versus low bar, the majority of elite power lifters squat with a low bar squat. Now, yeah, the bar is getting closer to your hips and stuff. However, I don't believe that it is making it any easier or harder on your hips than a high bar or a front squat. The moment arm is about the same, and the amount of activity you're getting from your hip extensors is about the same. However, dropping it down on your back decreases the thoracic extension demand. So if you're squatting high bar and your back rounds over, well, put it a little bit lower and you'll see that your back doesn't round. And I've actually started, so with beginners, I used to start high bar just because it's just more comfortable on their back. But I quickly learned that if you just put it low enough, they're just able to keep their backs tight right from the start, and it's much easier that way. But it just decreases the thoracic extension moment arm, and as the weight gets heavier, you're gonna want that to be decreased, you're gonna round over. On the bench press, the same thing. Think about it, if I have you bench, you know, whatever, you're not arching hard, but you lay down on the bench and I put a board on your chest. It's easier than if you have to touch it, right? Well, arch, shorten that range of motion, and then train the living shit out of it. Same thing, like if you're a close grip, if you have a close grip bench press, start widening the grip and then train the shit out of it. And like your pecs will catch up, they're a larger muscle group, and over time, I think in a lot of cases what we lose is we lose the bigger picture view. So yeah, it might be harder now, but 5 years from now you might have a bigger bench press. And your overall ceiling will be higher. Now, sumo and conventional, this seems to be like such a huge question that everybody thinks too much about. Same thing, just pick one and train it. They are different though. So like the conventional deadlift is gonna be more back and less quads. The sumo deadlift is gonna be more quads and less back. The sticking points for a conventional deadlift are gonna be below the knees. For the sumo deadlift, it's gonna be off the floor. If you do see other sticking points on the sumo deadlift, it's because they fuck something else up. So a lot of times you'll see them round over, the hips will pop up first, and then the chest is too far over the bar, and then you get that sticking point at the thighs.
So it almost looks like a conventional deadlift.
So yeah, it almost looks like a conventional. Like when it breaks the floor, if you freeze frame it right there, it'll look like a conventional deadlift with their feet wide. So the times that I'll switch people, because I don't really care, I think most people just think too much about it. So, you know, somebody like Nick who has a big squat, obviously has strong quads. Something like a sumo deadlift can help play to his strengths a little bit. I think that's great, and he has the work ethic to fix the technique and stuff. Somebody like Dave, who is very aggressive with the conventional deadlift, but his back's always rounding, right? So when you see the back, it starts flat, but then it turns into that like scared cat back look.
I was gonna say, he's talking about team cat back, yes. Those of us out there.
Right? Alyssa is also one of these people. But it's getting better. So what happens is from the floor, the erectors aren't strong enough. So you round over the back and makes it a little bit easier for them. But as the bar starts traveling upward, that moment arm for the erectors decreases. So then it becomes easy for the lifter to re-extend the spine. Now, I don't think this is necessarily gonna lead to injury or anything like that, like other people will talk about. However, if the knees are straightening as the back is rounding, you're losing that leg drive off the floor. So you're always gonna be better off if you can utilize more muscles at once and get them working together. So with Dave's case, he's got a big squat. So I know he has a leg strength, and just splitting his feet out wide and decreasing that demand on those back muscles now will immediately, right off the bat, allow him to utilize more muscles off the floor. Now he's been doing this since nationals, and he's already put weight on top of his deadlift. So, and that's just a positional thing. It just allows him to utilize more of his strength. So even before, he was capable of lifting more. It's just there was something holding him back, and it wasn't fixing him. Probably wouldn't fix fast enough because of the numbers he was lifting. Somebody like Bob. So when Bob started with me, his deadlift made me throw up in my mouth a little bit. It was really bad.
Bob.
Hi, Bob. You have the best hair in the team still, just not the best looking.
By the way, I'm going to put everybody's Instagrams in the show notes. So if you're like, I don't know who Bob is, I'm going to throw that phone out. But so if you're wondering who we're talking about, all of the athletes mentioned in this episode will be in the show notes. So if you're not, I'm sorry. But anyway, continue. All
right. So Bob has great hair. But his deadlift was very, very round. And he was pulling conventional at the time. So I had alluded to this a little earlier on one of the other questions. But it's harder to break a bad habit than to just start off on the right foot. So with Bob, I decided, because he's been fucking up the conventional deadlift for so long, and his back was round, so there are a number of factors here, that it would just be easier to relearn the sumo deadlift than to try to break the bad habit and then learn the conventional deadlift. And it didn't take long. I mean, within a couple months, like, his deadlift looks very good. He put some weight on top of it, and he's pulling sumo now. So, you know, where he hadn't fucked up that in at least, you know, he might have tried pulling sumo in the past or whatever, but it's so far away that, like, anything that he had done before is just kind of lost. So we were able to kind of build a new skill right from the start just to make it a little bit easier and faster moving. Then at some point, maybe we switch back to conventional, you know. It's good to be able to do both. There are other times, so, like, you know, Kerry has this weird hamstring thing that's kind of, you know, affecting her, and she can feel it on the deadlift, so we're pulling conventional. Like, there will be some carryover for your conventional deadlift to your sumo. I don't think there's as much the other way around because it's just not enough back. But, like, it's good to have both just in case. Mm-hmm. But I think people put too much stock in it.
So, TLDR.
What the hell?
Don't care. Too long, didn't read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
If you didn't listen to all that, it doesn't matter. Just train.
Pick one and train it.
Pick one, yeah. And then you'll get strong eventually. So we have like two more questions. Every time I go into this, my phone shuts off. We have like three actually. So I think these kind of go hand in hand. So when should you wear equipment? And when should you train at 90% or above? And are those linked in any way?
Okay, they're not. So I have a very different take on when you should wear equipment than I feel the majority of people out there. So I am a big proponent of you take every repetition like you're going to take it on the platform. If you wrap your wrist, you wrap your wrist. If you wear a belt, you wear a belt. If you wear heels normally when you squat, you wear heels on all your sets. If you wear knee sleeves when you squat, you wear knee sleeves when you're taking all of your reps. So however you are going to take your attempts on the platform, every repetition from 50% and higher should be taken with that same equipment on. Now, the reason for this is, one, specificity, but number two, it is very different squatting without a belt than it is with a belt, just the way it feels and the way you move. So if you're trying to warm up a specific movement pattern and it's going to be a belted squat, why would you warm up without the belt? It's like it's doing a different movement.
Don't look at me when you say that. That's so
I believe the barbell was wearing your belt time when you were squatting.
Last week I was doing squats and I left my belt on the end of the bar and squatted 6 reps with it stayed on the whole time, so I consider that to be a great squat anyway.
So I don't think it is necessarily gonna hurt you in any way. It's not like if you wear a belt all of a sudden, you know, your torso is stabilizing itself because the belt, you're still bracing the belt, it just changes the proprioception of the brace itself. It allows you to brace a little harder. In terms of training at 90%, I do feel that too many programs do train at 90% too often, and it's just risky. Like, you know, normally you start to see technique start to fall apart at greater than 85%. So typically when we train at 90%, we're gonna use boards on the bench, we're gonna use a slingshot on the bench, we're gonna use blocks on the deadlift. And for the squat, it gets a little tricky because we can't shorten the range of motion because we don't wanna practice a high squat. So things that we'll do are, we'll take heavier, like 85% for 4 sets of 2, or 80% for 5 sets of 3. You know, maybe 85% for triples. Like, we will do things like this, and there's this thing called exertion load and the stress index. So that second or third rep at 85% is going to be more difficult than a single at 90%, and your training load is going to be more. So just, it allows you to manipulate the training load. So you don't really need to touch 90% as much as you think. Now, with that said, I do feel psychologically that people get nervous if they haven't touched heavier weights before, probably because they don't understand some of these concepts. And the second they start to see those heavier weights on the bar, that anxiety makes it more stressful. So the more often that you touch 90%, the less stressful that it becomes. But that is a mental weakness problem that can be worked on in other ways. I think, you know, if you're gonna touch 90%, you know, once in a 4-week block or something is enough. But we'll hit it from blocks multiple times. We'll hit it from boards multiple times. So you're feeling that weight and stuff. We might use chains. So some of the girls that I have, they get a little bit nervous once they feel heavier weight on their back. So I'll just put chains on the bar so that at the top it's actually heavier than, you know, 85, 90% regardless. So like, what's your 70%?
70% is on deadlift?
On squats.
205.
So it's 205. So 75% is probably 225. So if we use, you know, between 70 and 75%, it's anywhere from 245 to 265 at the top, and her best squat's 295. So for a percentage, it's getting up there.
Yeah.
So you're feeling some heavier weights.
Mm-hmm.
But it's unnecessary. You know, technique needs to be, you need every rep to look the exact same. So it, you know, especially with a lot of novice and intermediate lifters, once it gets 80, 85%, they start turning into baby giraffes. And you need to just practice those. So maybe you start 80% for doubles. And until you master that, then 80% for triples. You master that, then you start hitting 85% for doubles. You master that, then 85% for triples. Like, once you build that stable movement pattern, 90% is going to be there and it's going to be stable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that the... Because I know a lot of people talk about women and men and how they handle heavier volumes differently. Do you think that, like, smaller lifters and or female lifters can handle heavier weight more often?
Yeah, I mean, it's easier because it's, you know, for the damage that's being done to the body, right, to the tissues, to the glycogen stores, to the hormones and stuff like that, absolute weight matters.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody like Kerry, who weighs 42 pounds, you know, even though she's a better lifter than I am, like, Wilkes-wise, competitive in her weight class-wise, however, her squat's not going to be as damaging to her as mine because I squat, you know, almost twice as much as her.
Yeah.
My deadlift's twice as much as her. So, like, that absolute weight is going to be a lot more damaging. So they're not going to be able to, the heavier weights, they're not going to be able to recover quite as quickly. So the only difference, though, is like, so Kerry and Danielle Bond are on similar training schedules. Kerry gets a little bit more volume. Danielle Bond gets a little bit less deadlift. So Kerry will deadlift a little bit more often. But overall, it's very, very similar. But their taper is very different. So because Kerry can recover faster, her test will be later, and her taper will actually be a little bit shorter. And I think that's where it matters most. Like, you know, our goal, we're trying to put the right weight on the bar for the right amount of repetitions for an entire training block. And, you know, what you're capable of recovering from, it's not this, like, set point. It's constantly moving. So it's something that needs to be constantly evaluated and adjusted as time goes along anyways.
That's fair. All right, we're on our last questions. I'm gonna combine them again, and you'll probably tell me that they don't go along with each other. So in terms of just how powerlifting is advancing the fitness industry and also the growth of both raw and female powerlifting over the last few years, like, where do you see that going? How do you think, maybe how do you think you're gonna impact it? How you see the trends progressing throughout 2018 and then maybe into 2019 as well?
No, I actually think these two things do actually go together. The fitness industry in general, I think you're starting to see trends happen, right? Like, even if you go into a commercial gym, you'll see turf laid out, you'll see platforms. Like, powerlifting is making an impact on the fitness community. The majority of the growth in the powerlifting community is coming from the female population.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you're gonna stop seeing that happen. I think you're gonna continue to see consistent growth, you know, for a little bit, like, you know, think of CrossFit when I first started, right? I think you're kind of see that same trend where, you know, this is 3-4 years into like these big jumps in the female growth of powerlifting. I think those big jumps will continue on. I think what you see is you'll start to see a much more competitive sport where you're gonna just see some massive freaking totals put out there by some young freaking people. I think you're gonna see a lot of world records broken. You know, with that, and as growth continues, I think you're gonna see the field be able to produce better information. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff like this always has a way of working itself out. Like powerlifting, you know, it used to only be Multiply, so all the information that was out there was just Multiply powerlifting stuff, and a lot of the stuff kind of hung around for quite a while, like, you know, tucking your elbows on a bench press, hips back, heels on the squat. Like, there were just a lot of things that just kind of hovered around. Now you're starting to see, like, those things are fading away. Like, most people know that, you know, the two sports are vastly different, and you have to go about them in very different ways in training and technique and stuff. So you're starting to see this raw powerlifting information growth where stuff that was hanging around is not there anymore, and it's just going to continue to grow, and I think you're going to have a much more educated consumer. I think it's going to weed out a lot of the bullshit.
People's BS meters are rising.
Yeah, people's BS meters are rising. You're going to have less Instagram powerlifting coaches or part-time coaches and stuff like that, and you're going to start to see a more established coaching field, maybe, that kind of hangs around, because I think quality will always win out in the end.
Do you think it'll boom as big as CrossFit did, like in terms of boxes popping up everywhere and, you know, moms and 11-year-olds signing up to be CrossFitters, but instead signing up to be powerlifters at, like, I'm trying to think of the right word, like, really cool barbell gyms, like, not just a commercial gym. Like, I feel like I've started to see more barbell gyms pop up that are not CrossFit gyms, that are, like, just powerlifting or just weightlifting gyms, I think.
Yeah, I think you're definitely going to see. I think there's definitely going to be a boom in those type of facilities. I think TPS is one of the only ones around here for a long period of time, and now I can name at least a handful of them that I could drive to in under an hour. And I think you're going to start to see that continue, and I think what you'll start to see is, because I think a lot of this population started with CrossFit. Mm-hmm. Like, it kind of made it cool to pick up a barbell again, and got people involved with picking up the barbell, and then, you know, they transition from that to this. I think what you might start seeing is, like, CrossFit boxes having designated powerlifting communities.
I know some do already, and I wonder if that's also because there is just more of a community, because the general fitness population is so heavily female in terms of just, like, consumer base. I do think, obviously, men are a huge portion of the fitness community in terms of, you know, bodybuilding being only men for so long, but in terms of, like, you know, diet culture, you know, fitness, not, like, a sport, just general fitness, I think women have been the big consumers of that for a long time, with, like, little pink dumbbells and that sort of thing. And women got into CrossFit, and now, like, there's a bajillion female CrossFit athletes who are strong and ripped as all fuck. So I feel like with the trending up of female powerlifting, I mean, women typically spend more money than men. It's just kind of a thing.
I mean, I think...
Do you think the business side will play into that at all, or?
I think if you're on that business side of it and you're not playing into it, you're going to be left behind. Like, I think you need to make it appealing for the female population, because, you know, the sport's growing, right? And they're the majority of the growth. They're the ones that are looking for coaches.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all of them will be looking for coaches for the most part. Very few of them, I think, are attempting to do it on their own. Like, whether it's free stuff online that they get, like, they're looking for some type of help. In that aspect of it. I don't see it stopping. I think social media just, it made it cool for females to pick up heavy things. I think that's great.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool.
And you have a YouTube channel.
Wow, great segue.
Talking about these things, Alyssa.
Yeah, I do. It was one of my, like, 2018... I guess it was one of my 2017 goals that didn't really happen in 2017.
Awesome.
So, yeah, I started a YouTube channel. I picked a really creative name for it. It's the exact same as my Instagram handle.
That's branding, though.
That's branding, yeah. I'm branding myself. And it's hard to say, also, Alyssa lifts things. I think we talked about this on the last episode, yeah.
I feel like a snake.
Yeah. But it kind of got inspired just because I had seen, you know, on social media, a couple people that I go to for valuable content talking about the lack of valuable content, specifically coming from female strength athletes. And I do think, like female powerlifting and females in CrossFit and weightlifting and other strength sports, I think that's going to continue to rise as well. But it's not as glamorous as, like, being a bodybuilder or being someone who maybe is a work-from-home fitness coach. So, I don't know. So I started this YouTube channel so that I could talk about more issues pertaining to female strength athletes and just the strength community in general, not just particularly powerlifting, though obviously that's my area of expertise and the area that I know the most about, so yeah.
I want to say too, with the, like, the female powerlifting thing, I don't think that, like, we need specific, like, men and women can do basically the same types of stuff in a powerlifting program.
Agreed.
Like, you know, yeah, certain women might be able to handle more volume, right?
But you have to perform the same lifts, yeah, at the end of the day.
But
so,
like, me and Nick handle different. I have higher volumes than Nick. Like, one man to another man of similar weights can handle different, yeah, volumes too, so it's not much. I think it's more of creating a community where, because, you know, we still see it at times where every guy tries to help out, you know, a girl that's lifting. It's just now with the growth of the powerlifting community, most of these girls are lifting more than the guy that's coming to them and telling them how they should do it.
Exactly.
But I think it's just creating a more appropriate environment for it, because, I mean, I even have lifters who told me they get dick pics in their DMs on Instagram based off of their lifting. So
I do as, yeah, well. I get DMs about how, I got one the other day, your legs look very strong, and I don't even know, it was not English, I declined it immediately. I didn't even open it. I was like, get out of here.
I do not get dick pics.
You are a fortunate man, yes, then. But yeah, I think mostly in terms of, like, issues pertaining to female strength athletes, I'm talking about, like, social issues.
Yeah.
So, like, just perception in the gym, how you are presenting yourself, what you are speaking about when you are at the gym. I think there is a lot to be learned in this area as women and men coexist in more unique spaces. I think there's just a lot to be learned, especially by men. Sorry. Not sorry.
Yeah. It's weird. I don't know why it ever turned into the way that it can be sometimes, but
I think it's just a culture thing, but I'm hoping that we can all have intelligent conversations. And
I mean, I think it takes care of itself over time too. I think, you know, as powerlifting is kind of a fad right now, so as it stops being a fad and kind of settles in and the women numbers are equal to the men's numbers for a period of time, not like weight numbers, but like total number of lifters, I think it'll just become more than the norm for,
yeah,
that. And I
agree.
Think, you know, I think too that the powerlifting community could use more female coaches. I think stuff like that would,
yeah,
help. And that'll happen over time. Like, it's just,
yeah,
like the general evolution of things. So I think it'll get better over time.
I agree.
Is that all the questions?
Yeah, pretty much.
I wonder if Big Al has hit his big bench yet.
He texted that he wants to wait for you.
Oh, that's special.
Because,
all right,
he doesn't feel like he can do it without you. Or no, it's not as fun without you.
I mean,
I think that he doesn't trust the handoff from
from Kyle. Like, Kyle's out there.
Is he? Oh.
Yeah. Oh. Well, we don't want to keep Big Al waiting. So, any closing thoughts, Alyssa?
No, I think this was a fun Q&A. I don't know. It wasn't really a Q&A. It was more just us battling, but still fun. So
yeah, I think there's some good stuff in there. All right. Well, next week we'll have a guest on. And after that, who knows? It's a whole wide world out there.
It's a whole wide world of 2018.
All right. We're going to sign off. Stay strong, Boston.